Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, October 24th, 2018. Riek Machar puts new conditions for his travel to Juba.
None of our demands has been met. These are principles of peace agreements. We are talking about provisions of the Axis being violated by the government, which is expecting us to go to Juba and dance with them.
And the South Sudan government gets a big donation from the African Bank.
This contribution will help us meet people's immediate food and nutrition needs of northern Bahr el-Ghazal, western Bahr el-Ghazal, Lakes, Jonglei, Unity, Western Equatoria, Warap and Upper Nile regions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The rebels with the SPLM-IO are setting conditions for their leader, Riek Machar, to attend peace celebrations in Juba next week. Stephen Parr is SPLM-IO's chairman for the group's Foreign Relations Committee. He says there is no peace to celebrate and Machar will not attend the government-sponsored festivities until President Salva Kiir releases all political prisoners.
What should take us to Juba is the peace agreement that we have just signed with the government. And the agreement is not being implemented. It was actually a resolution of the National Liberation Council of the SPLM-IO that we don't have a problem with celebration of peace in Juba, but there must be peace to celebrate. As we speak, there is no peace to be celebrated in Juba. You know the government is still on the offensive in central Equatoria, in western Equatoria, in western Bahr el-Ghazal. And the government is still holding the abductees, the detainees, and political detainees. There is no freedom of speech in Juba even today, and the state of emergency is not lifted.
Stephen Parr, one would argue that these are conditions you should have put during the negotiations. You don't bring conditions after you've already signed a document. You signed peace with Juba, now you're putting conditions.
Those are not conditions. There is a permanent ceasefire provision in the agreement that is not implemented, and that is not a new condition. The release of the detainees is also part of the agreement. And in fact, these detainees should have been released long time ago because the provision for the release of detainees was even in the cessation of hostility agreement. Way back in December 2017, none of the detainees has been released until today, especially the one they have abducted from Kenya.
Last week, the deputy head of mission at the South Sudan embassy was here at VOA and he said the government of South Sudan should not be asked for the whereabouts of Agri Idri and Samuel Dong because they were not abducted in South Sudan.
It is well known by the whole world, especially the human rights organizations and civil society organizations, even the United Nations, as witness that the government of South Sudan has been kidnapping people. And the people they are denying have been seen in Juba. They are part of the inmates who rose up weeks ago in the Blue House.
And you are telling me that your organization, the SPLM-IO, would go by the decision in this letter, meaning Dr. Riek Machar is not going to Juba on the 30th of this month. Is that what you're telling me?
That's what I'm telling you, because none of our demands has been met. And these are not just new conditions, as you put it. These are principles of peace agreements. And we are talking about provisions of the Axis being violated by the government, which is expecting us to go to Juba and dance with them at the time when they are still fighting us. The SPLM, SPLA, IO is fighting in self-defense in all of those fronts.
Fighting in self-defense is fighting. It doesn't mean you're not fighting. Fighting in self-defense is fighting.
Do you want us to surrender? Or what do you think we keep those weapons for? We keep those weapons to defend ourselves. We are an armed political organization.
Your absence at the peace celebration sends a message to the people of South Sudan. And here you are saying you are committed to implementing the peace agreement, and at the same time, you are not there when people are celebrating for the peace agreement.
By the way, the people of South Sudan know very well that there is no peace to celebrate now in South Sudan. The people can even tell you better. They are still in refugee camps. They are still being displaced. So where is the peace to celebrate them?
Were you forced to sign this peace agreement?
No, not necessarily. You know, we were revitalizing a framework that we signed first in 2015, before even Salva Kiir to sign the agreement. It is an agreement that we have negotiated in good faith twice now, and we have always been ahead of the government in terms of implementing the provision of that agreement.
That's Stephen Parr, SPLM-IO's Chairman of Foreign Relations Committee. He was speaking with me from the U.S. western state of Nebraska earlier today. The African Development Bank has given the government of South Sudan $44.5 million for implementing short-term regional emergency response project. A bank official says the donation will help feed the hundreds of thousands of hungry South Sudanese people and build community resilience. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Benedict Kanu, the African Development Bank's country manager for South Sudan, says the grant is intended to meet the growing food and nutrition needs of the suffering people in South Sudan.
The Say No to Farming short-term regional emergency response project in South Sudan, for which the African Development Bank has approved grants to the tune of $43.57 million to the government of the Republic of South Sudan, will help to ensure provision of emergency food assistance to the most vulnerable segments of the populations in South Sudan.
The funds will be managed by the World Food Programme. Adnan Khan, WFP's country director for South Sudan, says the contribution couldn't have come at a better time. Despite the September harvest, Kanu says more than 4.4 million people remain at crisis levels of food insecurity, a situation the WFP expects to continue until the end of the year. WFP says the number of people in need of assistance is expected to reach 5.2 million between January and March of next year. But Kanu says the African Bank's donation will help feed a lot of people.
This contribution will help us meet people's immediate food and nutrition needs, as well as support ongoing longer-term efforts to improve the resilience and food security of 300,000 people across 8 states of northern Bahr el-Ghazal, western Bahr el-Ghazal, Lakes, Jonglei, Unity, western Equatoria, Warap and Upper Nile regions.
Onyoti Adigo, South Sudan's agriculture and food security minister, says if the country is going to reduce widespread hunger, people must move from subsistence farming, where families grow food for domestic consumption, to commercial farming, where individuals and groups produce food for the market. Adigo hopes WFP will distribute farming tools to the South Sudanese people rather than ready food. He says distributing food aid encourages laziness.
I don't want people given free food. You can give children, you can coordinate it with the UNICEF for the vulnerable people, establish areas for them to feed them. Then also the most elderly people or the disabled, you can give them free food. But anybody with good hands, with walking strongly on foot, then I think those people should be given food for work.
Salvatore Garang, South Sudan's finance and economic planning minister, welcomes the grant and says the government will implement the project, but urged the WFP to buy food from local farmers and redistribute it to the needy.
We request both the World Food Programme and African Development Bank to contract the local companies when they are doing their business, as well as getting the surplus, to buy the surplus food from our people here, so that they empower our farmers in order to produce more, because this shall contribute to our economy, as money will be spent within the country.
A joint report released by the WFP, the UN Children's Fund, and the Food and Agriculture Organization late last month found that more than 6 million people in South Sudan, or over half the country's population, face extreme hunger due to continued conflict and insecurity. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, report said food insecurity had increased in counties of the Greater Upper Nile, Bragazal, and Greater Lakes regions due to poor access to health and nutrition services, extremely poor diets, and poor sanitation. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
10 leading human rights organizations have chosen 3 human rights defenders from Turkey, Colombia, and a Sudanese refugee in Papua New Guinea as finalists of the 2019 Martin Ennals Award. The award honors Amnesty International Secretary General from 1968 to 1980. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The 3 human rights defenders won out over 75 candidates because of their stubborn pursuit of justice for the rights of disadvantaged and marginalized people, often at great risk to their personal freedom and lives. Aaron Keskin, a lawyer and human rights activist in Turkey, was imprisoned in August 2016 as part of a national sweep 1 month after an attempted coup against the president. Director of the Martin Ennals Foundation, Michael Kambata, tells VOA at the time of her arrest, Keskin was editor-in-chief of a newspaper that dealt with Kurdish issues. He says she was held responsible for many of the published articles and was given a 12 and one half-year sentence. This currently is under appeal.
She has worked on basically on women's issues, everything from sexual assault in prison to that's one where she actually created an organization. She works on LGBTI issues and Kurdish issues and also on the Armenian genocide. Those have been her 4 main priorities since 1996.
The second nominee, Marino Cordoba Berrio, a member of the Afro-Colombian ethnic group, has been fighting for his people's right of ownership over their land. Kambata says he has faced threats and attacks from powerful landowners interested in exploiting the land for commercial logging and mining. The last nominee, Abdul Aziz Mohammed, is from Darfur in Sudan. He fled to the capital Khartoum, got into trouble as a student activist, and fled again to Australia seeking asylum. He has been in detention on Manus Island, Papua New Guinea, for the past 5 years. Kambata says Mohammed has been advocating for the hundreds of men who are living in horrid, punitive conditions on the island. He does this through the skillful use of social media and podcasts.
He keeps things peaceful, and he has been a voice to the wider world, particularly to Australia, on the impact and the consequences. The real thing that he highlights is not so much the actual conditions of the camp, but the fact that they have nowhere to go and they have no future.
The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, will announce the laureate of the Martin Ennals Award February 13th. The winner will receive a cash prize of $30,000. The 2 runners-up will receive $10,000 each. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a closer look at the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you consider yourself traditional or modern?
Modern. I'm not traditional. I'm really modern. Updated with the technology. The way I dress is all modern. Staying in the city, urban ways of life, that is it.
Traditional, because as the Swahili says goes, mwacha mila ni mtumwa. It's good that you go by your cultures rather than going to the modern one because you don't know its disadvantages. So it is better to go with the one that you know the advantages and the disadvantages.
Some traditional things that are dear to me and the modern things that I hold on to.
I embrace traditional aspects. I'm also embrace modernity. So it's a mixture of both.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Another rash of deadly attacks is again hampering international efforts to control an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The outbreak is in a conflict zone where more than 100 armed groups operate. Aid agencies knew from the start the unrest would affect their work. Every time there is an attack, it's followed by angry protests that force health workers to stay indoors. That provides opportunities for Ebola to spread despite a new vaccine and new drugs. The death toll now stands at 157 from 244 confirmed cases and suspected cases. The UN Secretary General and other officials have urged an end to the violence amid concerns the outbreak could spread to neighboring countries, including South Sudan. World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Jasovic talked with my colleague Paul Alexander about the situation.
We had a series of serious incidents over the weekend that once again presented themselves as a serious setback to the operations because we know from the previous experiences that any security incidents, whatever nature it is, are followed by protests from local population, and that inevitably stalls our operations. We have teams who, again, were not able to operate on Sunday, that on Monday we were operational really at a very low level. And this, unfortunately, will have effect on the overall response. So again, WHO is appealing to everyone to work toward creating a safe environment in which our teams will be able to access population and do all those necessary measures that are needed.
So how much time and effort is going into security issues each day?
Well, again, the situation is very unpredictable. So what happened really over the weekend, there was a number of incidents that resulted in around 13 civilian deaths. And these incidents range between fighting between rebel and government forces that happened on Saturday. And then on Sunday, what happened is what we have seen already in the past, that situation was such that population staged a protest in the city because they were not really happy, understandably, with the level of security. They think that that the government, together with the international peacekeeping mission, is failing to provide that security. And in a response, there was a number of stones being thrown and property being destroyed of response teams. And that obviously will create a situation where we will not be able to function fully. For example, yesterday morning I talked to our teams. Only essential teams were able to go out very early in the morning to their places of work, such as Ebola treatment centers, and then others who were not able to go out. And we know that what this will have as a result is that contacts will not be followed. This is something that has to be done on a daily basis in Ebola response. Those who are on a contact list have to be followed every day, and this did not happen. Some people will simply go away from that contact list and will not be seen any longer. What will that result in turn, is that people who may develop disease will not go immediately to treatment centers and will present danger to their environment. And again, we get into this situation where then we will have to go again, do the epidemiological work, again try to find people who may have been exposed. So the response gets delayed and gets accumulated, if you want.
Considering that this situation does not seem to be getting better, at least as far as security, what does this do for the outlook for bringing this outbreak under control?
Well, it is very simple. In case we are not able to access communities, if in case response measures are not being put in place, safe burials, contact tracing, vaccination, provision of treatment to those who are sick, it is really difficult to hope that the Ebola outbreak can be contained on its own. So it's a very serious
situation. And this is something that we have been fearing from the beginning, that the security situation will influence the response to the level that that we cannot really function fully, and that that will be then having a result on the epidemiological curve of the disease.
That's Tarek Jesovic with the WHO. He was speaking with my colleague Paul Alexander. Human Rights Watch is accusing government forces of committing mass atrocities against civilians that include killings, burning of villages, and looting civilian property in former Western Bahr Ghazal state. A report released today also accuses SPLA-IO rebels of recruiting child soldiers, beating up civilians, and looting property. Both groups deny responsibility. ONN Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
Human Rights Watch researchers talked to 110 witnesses who say they bore the brunt of the military's counterinsurgency campaign in villages south and west of Wau town. They say government soldiers shot and killed civilians while they were fleeing. The report says during a period between June and late August, government soldiers burnt houses, destroyed crops, and looted food and domestic animals. Witnesses said soldiers also looted a church and occupied two health centers. Jehani Henry, the Associated Africa director at Human Rights Watch, says civilians fled villages of Greater Bagari area, Giza, Boro, Gok, Balak.
And they told us about how soldiers came and looted and destroyed property and forced them to flee. The area was blocked from humanitarians and human rights observers and aid groups.
Despite the signed peace deal, Henry says fighting continues in the Western Wau region.
Years-long divisions that already exist in Wau after multiple years of fighting reaching the town, the ethnic polarization is just continuing with this situation, making the situation worse, including in the town.
SPLA-IO spokesperson Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel denies his group abused civilians in the area because they have strong ties to the people. Henry is calling on the government and rebels to stop carrying out retaliatory attacks on each other so aid groups can access the area to provide much-needed life-saving assistance to civilians.
So part of our call is that proper investigations can be done. These types of crimes against civilians must not be part of this war in South Sudan, and they have to stop immediately.
And Henry called on both sides to grant access to aid agencies and human rights investigators, as stipulated in the revised peace agreement. It was not possible to get a comment from the government military spokesman, Brigadier General Lul Roy Kong. Kong said he was in a meeting and later did not answer repeated calls. For VOA News, I am ONN Walter Solomon in Juba.
The murder in Istanbul of the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, allegedly at the behest of Saudi officials, has made global headlines. But worldwide, hundreds of journalists are attacked, imprisoned, or even killed every year by those in power. Angela Quantel, the Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, told VOA Adams Philip why she thinks Khashoggi's story has caught fire in the public imagination.
Well, I guess it's caught fire simply because this is an international journalist, someone who was working as a columnist for the Washington Post and therefore would have the sort of profile that would get people to take note. That's generally not the case with the vast majority of murders that you see of journalists, because these are generally local journalists in countries that often the international community doesn't particularly care about. I mean, let's be real.
So what about the news out of Africa? Are things good or bad, improving or getting worse?
I'd say it's mixed. Let's just talk about the good news in terms of journalists in jail. At the end of 2017, in terms of our prison census, we had 39 journalists in jail for their work. As I sit here and I talk to you, we're down to only 15. Now, that is tremendous. And the 15 are only in one country, Eritrea. Eritrea has been on our census list since 2001, when the Eritrean government decided to get rid of the independent press and started jailing many, many journalists. And to this day, we're not even sure whether they are still alive, because the situation there is just so opaque. And unfortunately, the international community seems to ignore what is going on there.
To go back to the good news, you say the numbers have gone down enormously. What do you attribute this positive trend to? I mean, why do you suppose things are so much better these days?
Let me use the example of Ethiopia. In 2016, we had 16 Ethiopian journalists in jail. Last year, over the same period, we were down to 5. Right now, there are none. You do have a reformist prime minister, a young prime minister. He has opened up the space for journalists and others.
Yet the killing of journalists has continued somewhat in Africa over the past year.
We've had 3 journalists killed in the Central African Republic and 1 other journalist in Libya. In the Central African Republic, 3 Russian journalists who were investigative journalists were visiting the country because they were following up on the mercenary group with links to President Vladimir Putin, and they were murdered. They were found dead in a vehicle. And we are trying to get to the bottom of what really happened. There are conflicting sources of information. The problem with murders of journalists, as we see all over the world, is the complete impunity. So when people are murdered, to try and actually find their killers or to hold the killers to account is almost impossible.
What about Zimbabwe?
Look, it always helps when you have new governments. Zimbabwe's not out of the woods yet, but certainly we've seen some change there.
I understand things are very bad for free press and for journalists in Cameroon.
Cameroon is very bad. The repression that we have seen in Cameroon under President Paul Biya has played itself out in the media as well. Cameroon has used anti-terror legislation against journalists and opposition and anyone who is critical of the government. While we saw many journalists released last year, including the famous case of Ahmed Abba, the Radio France International journalist who had also been accused of terrorism, we still have journalists in jail in Cameroon as we speak.
Is danger to journalists most critical in Africa as opposed to other places?
Definitely not. I mean, every continent has journalists who are seen and being regarded as the so-called enemies of the state. So no, Africa is certainly not alone in the way that it treats journalists or abuses journalists. Here in North America, we have problems as well, and we have the problem in the United States. I think at the end of the day, this is not about only journalists. This is about the public's right to know. Once you kill a journalist, you are killing the public's right to know. It's the journalist today. It could be you, the citizen of a country, tomorrow.
That's Angela Quantal, the Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips, in New York. That brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with a peace song by a group from the former Western Bahr al-Ghazal state. That was a test of a peace song from a group from Western Bahr al-Ghazal. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you inviting us into your homes and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Juru sawa sawa, lagi kakak.